on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. I hope you're having a very happy and healthy week. And if not, then I hope you've been following the hints and tips I've been giving you over a week to deal with, yes, the dreaded coronavirus. We can't escape it, can we? So, yes, I shall be talking about that again in this evening's show. But also, I'm going to be talking about some other things as well, just to take our minds off it for a little while. So I'm going to be giving you the usual news roundup as well. But then I'm going to be going on to finding out how we're coping at home. And while some of us may be doing quite well, others of us may not. So let's have a little think about home activities. Now, first of all, the news roundup. Now, people who grew up with a dog apparently are less likely to suffer from schizophrenia when they reach adulthood. But it must be a dog. Apparently, cat owners don't get the same mental health benefits. Those who had a pet dog in their first 12 years were up to 24% less likely to have schizophrenia. But it didn't protect against bipolar disorder, and the pet cat didn't have any impact on either problem. That's according to researchers at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center. They questioned a group of just over 1,300 people between 18 and 65 years old, nearly 400 of whom had schizophrenia. 381 were bipolar and the rest didn't have any mental health issues at all. They asked them about having a pet dog or cat growing up. Now, the greatest protection seemed to be between birth and the age of 3, although the researchers said there was a positive effect up to the age of 12. The researchers don't really know why having a dog has such a positive impact on mental health, but they think it may have a physical cause, with perhaps something in a dog's microbiome bolstering a person's immune system in a way that protects them against psychiatric disorders. Well, I think it's very healthy to have a pet dog anyway. I think from as young as I can remember, I've had pet dogs, actually. Yeah. And in fact, I'm just thinking back to even when I was born, the family had a dog even before I was born. So, yes, dogs have been a constant. And I'm not saying that's the reason why I've not suffered any of those particular mental illnesses. But it's certainly, I think it's a good thing to have an animal. It teaches you about caring and looking after something outside of yourself. And orthopaedic surgeons can be keen to get patients out of the hospital even on the same day of total hip or knee replacement surgery. But just be wary of that one, because it can be a dangerous practice that could double the chances of lung or heart complications. Even staying in the hospital overnight dramatically reduces the risk of serious complications. That's according to researchers from the Weill Medical College at Cornell University. Patients who leave the hospital the day of the procedure are nearly twice as likely to suffer serious cardiac or pulmonary complications within the first 30 days, often within the first few days, and in some cases the risk was nearly four times greater than for patients who stayed in the hospital overnight. The risk was also slightly higher among patients who had undergone total hip arthroplasty, that's replacement or rebuilding. And the practice of same-day discharge goes against traditional best practice guidelines, but it has become increasingly common in the past decade because of financial restraints, along with improvements in surgical procedures and rehabilitation care. In 2018, total knee replacement surgery became a same-day procedure, and hip replacement is expected to be similarly recognised by the Centre for Medicare and Medicaid Services very soon. But the practice isn't as safe as earlier studies have found. Of the 226,000 knee replacement procedures tracked by the researchers, just over 3,000 had been sent home the same day, as had 2,600 of the 140,000 patients given a new hip, and they were twice as likely to develop complications. So if you do go in for any of that kind of surgery, then just be aware of the possible complications, and maybe have an overnight stay in hospital just to be on the safe side. And skin creams, toothpaste and fragrances can trigger an itchy rash. And that rash is called contact dermatitis, which is a type of eczema. even if they've been tested and passed all the safety checks. Compounds in the products pass under the radar in standard safety tests, but they're still being seen by the body's immune system because of a complex chemical reaction that happens when they're put on the skin. Now, chemicals in the products interact with a common immune molecule in the skin called CD1A, essentially by replacing natural fat molecules or lipids in the molecule to change its structure. And it's this process that makes it a target of our immune system's T cells and ultimately causes the rash. Now, among the compounds tested, those most likely to cause a skin rash are balsam of Peru and farnesol, which are both found in many skincare products. That's according to researchers from Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Benzyl benzoate and benzyl cinnamate are the main active ingredients in balsam of Peru that cause the reaction, and overall the research discovered some 12 small molecules that could have a similar effect. The only solution is to stop using the cosmetics, while topical ointments can help soothe the rash. And severe cases may have to be treated with oral corticosteroids, the researchers say. But they are also looking at ways of developing an ointment that applies other lipids to the skin first, thus blocking the process from the start. So, just be aware of that. So you could even be using skin creams that are actually bringing your skin up in rashes. So just be aware of what the ingredients are. Always opt for the most natural ingredients. And around 25% of cases of autism are not being diagnosed, especially among Hispanic and African American children in the US. This suggests the disorder, already described as an epidemic that affects one in 42 boys, is even more prevalent than previously thought. Researchers from Rutgers University's New Jersey Medical School looked at the medical reports of 266,000 children who were 8 years old in 2014 to discover how many showed symptoms of the disorder but had not been clinically diagnosed. Of the 4,500 children identified as having autism symptoms, 25%, or one in four, had never been diagnosed, and most of the undiagnosed cases were found among Black or Hispanic boys. Symptoms included difficulties with mental ability, social skills, and daily activities, and yet families were not getting any help or assistance. Language, communication, or cultural barriers could all be playing a part in not getting a diagnosis, the researchers are thinking, and this could be coupled with a fear about the stigma of having an autistic child and the complicated diagnosis process. Now, early signs of autism could also be incorrectly seen as behavioural or medical problems. That's according to the researchers. Now, screening all toddlers, preschool and school-aged children could help identify cases that are currently slipping under the radar, and clinicians could overcome language barriers by using pictures to improve communication. Now, obviously, that's talking about the US, but I think that's also relevant over here as well. Postmenopausal women are at high risk of developing atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, because of the level of lead in their body. Lead is a toxic metal that can build up from cigarette smoke, drinking water, and car exhaust, and it raises the risk of artery disease by 72% in this population. The metal seems to affect the carotid arteries, which run along either side of the neck and feed the oxygen to the brain, and so any blockage of these can increase the risk of stroke. Although many studies have linked lead exposure to cardiovascular disease, researchers from Sahlgrenska University Hospital in Sweden are among the first to focus on its effects on postmenopausal women. They think the women are particularly vulnerable because menopause can increase bone mineralisation, which allows lead stored in the bones to pass into the bloodstream. Artery stiffness can also increase during the menopause, and this could be another factor. And overall, lead is estimated to be the cause of 2% of all cases of cardiovascular disease and is directly responsible for 240,000 deaths around the world every year. People with kidney disease were also at a higher risk of developing atherosclerosis, probably because they were less able to process the lead. And bad news now, drinking a little alcohol every day, even a single glass or two, increases your risk of cancer, but just a little bit. Drinking one drink every day for 10 years or two drinks a day for 5 years raises the risk by 5%. One drink contains 23 grams of ethanol, which is the equivalent of a bottle of beer, a 6-ounce glass of wine, or 2 ounces of whiskey. And although the amount we drink is a factor, the risk is more linked to the frequency of drinking, and so the antidote is to drink less often or not at all. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have been investigating this, and they've taken a special interest in the causes of cancer because it's the biggest killer in Japan and is far more lethal than heart disease, which remains the deadliest disease in the West. They analysed clinical data from 63,200 cancer patients and compared them to a similar number of healthy controls, and both groups reported on the amount and frequency of the alcohol that they drank. So, maybe not drinking every day, but again, little and often. It's difficult though, isn't it? Particularly in these times. So what are we all up to in our homes? What's happening in our houses while we're being confined? I'm going to talk to you about that in a moment. Let's take a break first. I'll be back with you after this.
What's the sense in sharing this one and only life? Ending up just another lost and lonely wife. You count up the years and they will be filled with tears. Love only breaks up to start over again. You'll get the babies, but you won't have your man. While he's busy loving every woman that he can. Say I'm gonna leave 100 times a day. It's easier said than done when you just can't break.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, what are we doing at home? Now, many of us are being forced to work from home during this current crisis. And as a result of that, well, being in isolation as well, not just working, probably drinking more alcohol, eating less healthy food and having problems sleeping, a study has found. A survey of 500 workers by the Institute of Employment Studies also revealed a significant increase in muscle, bone, ligaments, tendons and nerve complaints. And more than half of those questioned reported feeling new aches and pains, especially in the neck, shoulder and back, compared with their normal physical condition. The survey also suggested that exercise and diet are both on the wane, with more than half of the workers acknowledging that they are exercising less and a third confessing to eating a more unhealthy diet. Now, the lockdown is obviously been implemented to slow down the spread of coronavirus, but it's resulted in gyms closing with people only allowed out to exercise once a day. Meanwhile, one-fifth of respondents admitted to partaking in more alcohol than they would ordinarily be consuming. Poor sleep and increased risk of exhaustion are also cause for concern. That's according to the Institute of Employment Studies. And most respondents reported a loss of sleep due to worry, as well as an increase in the corresponding symptoms of fatigue. Half said that they're working long and irregular hours and aren't happy with their current work-life balance. And one in three said that they frequently feel isolated. More than a fifth are worried about job security. These interim findings paint a picture of a new home working workforce that faces significant physical and mental well-being challenges. That's according to the Institute of Employment Studies. Employers need to recognise they're still responsible for the well-being of their staff, even when working from home. And there are a number of steps they can do to or can take to improve employee well-being. And you'll find the full report on the Institute of Employment Studies website. But something that you can do to help your eyesight, because obviously there's a lot of staring at screens, isn't there, this time? Researchers say exposure to blue light could increase the risk of damage to eyesight and make it harder to fall asleep. So here are some tips. If you're working most of the day looking at a screen. Now, work an arm's length from the screen. So fully extend your arm and work from a distance, looking from your eyes to the end of your fingertips. And use this as a minimum distance to reduce the stress on your eyeballs. Every 20 minutes, look away from the screen for a minimum of 20 seconds and looking at least 20 feet away. So that's easy to remember, isn't it? So that's 20, 20, 20. So every 20 minutes, look away from the screen, 20 seconds, 20 feet away. That just gets the eye muscles working, because otherwise your muscles get stuck looking like right in front of you, don't they? It just helps to reset your visual systems. And eyes through any long periods of screen work. And height and level of your working screen can have a big impact on eye strain as well. And research has shown that it's better for the screen to be located higher than the user's watching level. So the middle point should be 5 to 6 inches below the straight line of the user's vision. This makes the space between upper and lower eyelid more open, often resulting in dryness of the eyes. So we've got to have it below the straight line of your vision, not higher than that, in other words. So you'd be looking down on it rather than up. And position the computer screen to avoid glare, particularly from overhead lighting or windows. Use blinds or drapes on windows and replace the light bulbs in desk lamps with bulbs of lower wattage and intensity. And if there's no way to minimise glare from light sources, consider using an anti-glare filter. Now, normally in a minute, we blink up to 20 times. There's that number 20 again. This is controlled automatically by our central nervous systems, so we're not conscious of blinking. Now, while we're staring at screens, this can actually reduce to about 3 to 5 times a minute, meaning our tear films cannot be maintained and the eye doesn't remain lubricated. So a post-it note on your monitor saying blink should help you consciously make an effort to blink. So it's a simple thing, but it definitely works. So just put that little post-it in and then just have a blink for a few times, you know, just very quickly. And it helps to lubricate the eyes again. And, well, in technological terms, usually the biggest, newest phone is the best, but not for your eyes. An iPhone 10 is 20% brighter than an iPhone 6 and emits higher levels of blue light. And this is the difference of a 100% increase in harmful blue light exposure. So if you've got an older phone, stick with it. And it's a good idea, really, to have no digital devices or artificial lighting after sunset. Now, if you're like most people, you're probably just sending a last minute email or finishing off your favourite show on Netflix before bed. So try reading a book or start a meditation or something that you promised yourself you'll do in the new year. You shouldn't assume that night mode or blue shade on devices is enough to counter the impact of blue light. This has been proven to not aid sleep compared to a screen's normal output, and so even with it enabled, you should still avoid the screen after sunset if at all possible. Which, you know, okay, we've got longer days now, so that's not quite as bad, is it? If it was winter time, it probably would be worse, but yeah, I think that's doable, isn't it? And there are screen protectors that you can get to filter out blue light as well, that that do a reasonable job of kind of soothing the eyes if you've got constant screen work during the day. And the problem is you're working on the screen all day, aren't you? Probably if you're working from home. And then, because in the evening, you're relaxing with the screen as well, aren't you? You're on your phone, catching up on social media, etc. So you're spending your whole day with your eyes glued to a screen of some description, which obviously isn't going to be very healthy for you. So just try some of those tips and hopefully that will work for you. Well, aside from screen staring, we need to be aware of what we're eating as well. It's all too easy to fall into bad eating habits. And, you know, coronavirus or not, we ought to be eating healthily, building up our bodies and keeping our bodies fit. So eating foods rich in vitamin D is good for our bones, teeth and muscles. And lovers of cheese, eggs and oily fish will also be delighted to discover that they're just as good for the heart too. As scientists have found that these foods may protect against a heart attack or stroke. And crucially, they found that the intake of vitamin D in food rather than through supplements is the best way to get the benefits. Additionally, the benefits were far more marked in men than in women, and a survey of more than 3,000 people over 11 years recorded the number of times a month they ate commonly consumed food and drinks and in what portions. Fish and eggs were the participants' primary sources of vitamin D, which is known as the sunshine vitamin, as the body makes it when exposed to sunlight. Now, these results were published in the Journal of Human Nutrition and Dietetics, and they showed those with the highest vitamin D intake had the lowest risk of cardiovascular health problems, such as a heart attack or stroke. And men with the lowest vitamin D intake in their food had the highest risk, researchers found, but no significant trend was observed in the same group for women. Previous studies of vitamin D supplements have shown that they have little beneficial effect on heart health. But researchers at the Harakopio University in Athens said consuming foods high in vitamin D may have heart protective effects. In contrast with vitamin D supplementation, this study revealed that increased vitamin D intake from food sources may protect against heart-related problems, especially in men. So, to the best of their knowledge, this study is one of the very few to evaluate the separate association of vitamin D intake received exclusively from food. Now, I note at the moment as well, there's lots of people that are on vitamin D supplements. I think this is not just as straightforward as taking a vitamin D supplement. There's D1, D2, D3. All sorts of vitamin D type supplements. But according to this particular report, it's much better to get the vitamin from food rather than just taking a supplement. So that kind of makes sense in a way, because you've got the full gamut of everything going into your stomach, so the body can digest everything fully. Which is often a problem when taking vitamins or minerals. They just get excreted out by the body because there's nothing kind of substantial in there to help them be absorbed by the body. Okay, we're going to take a little break now. And after the break, we'll be looking at what scientists know or what they've been finding out about the virus itself and the advice that we've been being given. So, yeah, stay tuned for more right after this.
Wear my heart on the sleeve, I'm not afraid. Say what I mean what I say. Set myself up, let myself down. I made it a fool, spread it around. But I just wanna let you know, sometimes I and I let my feelings go. Ooh, wear my heart on my sleeve. Don't count the cost if I can't live enough. And surely I've lost. Oh, you tend to get burned, tend to get bruised, but it's my life.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. So yes, how our lives have changed in just a few months. You know, who would have thought that all this would have been going on at Christmas time when we were enjoying ourselves with our families, etc. Now there are more than a million people infected worldwide, and it's claiming the lives of hundreds of Britons every day, and we still have no idea when the outbreak will end and life will get back to normal. But at the same time, the scientific understanding of the virus is advancing at a remarkable pace. So let's have a think about what we've learned and how that knowledge might help us to defeat it. Our social distancing guidance is to keep 2 metres away from people we don't live with. Now, this rule is thought to be based on experiments from the 1930s that suggested droplets released from coughs and sneezes can travel between 1 and 2 metres. But this understanding may be outdated. In an experiment to be shown very shortly, I think it is, by the Health and Safety Executive, a cough From a medical mannequin called Violet, provides a graphic illustration of just how easily and how far coronavirus particles can spread. Now, in the demonstration, Violet coughs up a liquid laced with a dye that shows up under ultraviolet light. The dye is meant to reveal how droplets containing coronavirus particles are propelled through the air when we cough. So you see thousands of droplets coming out of Violet's mouth, with some reaching the ceiling and the far wall, which is at least 2 meters away. So some of these droplets could land on hands, so even though you're not in the direct line of the coffin, if those droplets contain the virus, then you will be infected because it is incredibly contagious. And the experiment shows why you need social distancing of at least 2 meters, but even at that, you're just on the fringe of where the spread could be happening. So I think the answer is stay out of the way of anybody that's coughing, and if you are coughing, make sure that you cover your mouth. New research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that 2 meters may not be nearly far enough, and that coronavirus particles can be propelled up to 8 meters by sneezes and 6 meters by coughs. And some experts suggest that larger droplets in saliva and mucus, the ones believed to carry COVID-19, will fall safely to the ground within 2 meters. However, the US researchers said their experiment calls into question our understanding of what a safe distance might be to protect ourselves from this infection. Another report even suggests we may have more than coughs and sneezes to worry about. National Academy of Sciences in the US recently warned that the virus may be spread by the fine mist we produce when we talk and breathe. And one study suggests this can spread genetic material from the virus more than 2 meters away from patients. This raises the possibility that the virus can linger in the air and potentially infect someone later who walks by. Gosh, so there's like a mist hanging in the air that you just kind of walk through, and that's filled with the virus. That's just weird, isn't it? That sounds like sci-fi stuff, doesn't it? But all this research has prompted the World Health Organization to start a review of its advice on the use of face masks. So there's been much debate over the value of face masks to protect you from the virus and also to stop you spreading it. And many scientists are skeptical about whether it's worth healthy people wearing masks. There are concerns about people's hands becoming contaminated when they put on and take off the masks, and that someone wearing a mask might lower their guard in other ways. For example, by cutting back on their hand washing. Plus, the virus can still get in through any gaps at the sides of the masks, and the person's eyes as well are a possible entry point for the virus, and they're still exposed. Now, University College London Hospital's NH Foundation Trust isn't convinced that healthy people need to wear masks. They say that having something on your face may want you to touch it more, and if you keep 2 meters away from everyone else outside, you don't need a face mask. However, others argue that masks can provide a physical barrier to the droplets that spread the virus, particularly from people who are infected and don't have any symptoms. The World Health Organization is currently reviewing its advice that face masks should only be worn by those who have coronavirus or by those people looking after others who may have it. The spread of COVID-19 by people who aren't showing symptoms is one of the reasons the virus is so dangerous, and a study published in the journal Science concluded that 86% of cases either have no symptoms or very mild ones. And countries such as Iceland and South Korea have reported a huge number of silent spreaders. In South Korea, 40.2% of those aged 20 to 29 fell into this bracket. So it's not known why some people don't show symptoms, but it may be due to differences in their genetics. And whether you have symptoms or not, the virus will be released from your respiratory system into the air, and the droplets can last for many hours on different surfaces, which we may then touch. And a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine revealed the virus can survive suspended in the air for up to 3 hours. It can stay on cardboard for 24 hours and plastic for 72 hours. And this could have implications for online shopping as well. And in countries that seem to have managed the outbreak pretty well, such as Singapore and Taiwan, all deliveries are treated very seriously because it's clear that this could be another mode of transmission. With deliveries, there is advice that plastic items should be wiped down with soap and water. And other experts say you're unlikely to reach every nook and cranny, so we'll be better off just keeping your hands clean and obviously not putting your hands near your face, mouth, eyes, nose, etc., or ears. Now, the official advice is that the two main symptoms of COVID-19 are a high temperature with a new and continuous cough. In fact, data gathered by the WHO in February on more than 55,000 confirmed cases in China showed a fever to be the most common symptom, occurring in 87.9% of cases, followed by a dry cough in 67.7%. Other symptoms included fatigue, coughing up phlegm, sore throats, headaches and diarrhoea and vomiting. And another symptom has emerged as well, loss of sense of smell. Data collated by ENT UK, which represents ear, nose and throat specialists, suggests this inability to smell and often to taste may be the very first sign. In fact, a new report from King's College London points to it being one of the most common symptoms. They analysed data submitted by 1.5 million users of a new symptom tracking app, and those who had tested positive for the virus were much more likely to have lost their sense of smell and taste than have a fever. Dr. Van Tulken, whose brother Xander has had COVID-19 for the past 2 weeks, says Xander's sense of taste and smell was so affected by the virus that he was able to eat a pot of mustard. Good grief! It looks like this is quite a strong diagnostic predictor. So Dr. Xander, who you probably know from the TV, is a normally healthy 41-year-old. He had a high fever, extreme fatigue, muscle aches, dry cough, and entirely lost his sense of smell and taste. And he also developed an abnormal heart rhythm and had to go to hospital for a cardioversion, which is a treatment that uses electric shocks to jolt the heart back into its normal rhythm. Now, it's known that older people and those with underlying conditions such as type 2 diabetes and heart and lung diseases such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or COPD are more likely to become severely ill with coronavirus. A report in The Lancet, where researchers from Imperial College London analysed data from China, showed how the risks of serious illness and death rise sharply as we get older. This is thought to be because our immune systems weaken with age, making us more vulnerable to infections. Also, we're more likely to have underlying health conditions as we age that increase the risk of severe disease. And also a phenomenon called a cytokine storm, which is a potentially fatal overreaction of the immune system, becomes more common as we get older. While a 20-year-old has about a 1% chance of their illness being so severe that they're hospitalised, the risk rises to around 4% for someone in their 40s, 8% for someone in their 50s, and 19% for the over 80s. But younger people are not invincible. Data from NHS England shows that while the vast majority of the thousands of deaths in England have been in the over 60s, some younger people under 60 have also lost their lives to COVID-19. So it's something that even young people need to take carefully. And I know some very young children as well, just a few of them, thankfully, do seem to have lost their lives as well. So why can a seemingly young and healthy person be struck down with the virus? And it is possible that some people's genetics make them more vulnerable. And another theory revolves around the viral load, which is the amount of virus someone is initially exposed to. And with some viruses, the more you breathe in, the sicker you get, which could explain why young nurses who are in close contact with lots of sick patients are dying from coronavirus. So they're getting like several doses of it in one go. Yeah, those are just some of the things we've learned. Right, I think it's time to take another little break now. And we're going to be thinking about some of these other scientific things that we've learned as well right after this break. So stay tuned for more after this.
Your hand is in my hand. Words could not how much you mean to me. There must be some other way to make you see. If it takes my heart and soul, you know I'd pay the price. Everything that I possess, I'd gladly sacrifice. Oh, you to me are everything, the sweetest song that I could sing. Oh, baby, oh, baby. To you, I guess I'm just a clown who picks you up each time you're down. Oh, baby, oh, baby. You give me just a taste of love to build my hopes upon. You know you got the power. A change of heart. If it takes forever, girl, then I'm prepared to wait. The day you give your love to me won't be a day too late.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, and yeah, we're talking coronavirus again, of course. Well, we're surrounded by numbers and figures, and we're hearing about this on a daily basis. And, you know, what exactly can we believe? Because comparisons between coronavirus deaths in different countries, for example, can be misleading. And each country is counting things differently. And some are choosing not to count the deaths that happened outside of hospitals, while others may not be counting cases where the individual was already sick. And while the daily death rate in the UK is rising still, the figures don't tell us how fast the virus is actually spreading. The people who are dying are likely to have contracted the virus 3 weeks ago. And since then, a raft of restrictions have been introduced and the effects of the lockdown have yet to be reflected in the figures. And the UK death rate should start to decline soon. And in a way, things are getting better, but we're just not going to be seeing it until a little later on. An experiment that was done simulating a pandemic of a deadly flu virus revealed how quickly the contagion could be slowed simply by hand washing. Washing hands an extra 5 to 10 times a day would halve the number of people who caught the virus in the next 100 days, slashing the number of patients from 42 million to 21 million. The way that pandemics spread is all exponential, which means tiny things can have a massive impact. Things like hand washing done properly can genuinely make a difference. And more than 35 universities, biotech and drug companies worldwide are racing to produce a vaccine to stop this virus in its tracks. And the vaccine research is proceeding at an alarming rate, actually, which is brilliant. And vaccines are being developed in America, Imperial College in London, and also by the Chinese as well. So there's all sorts of people that are working hard together to try and find a vaccine for this awful virus. And tests on mice actually have produced a massive antibody response, and tests on monkeys are now underway with a small trial in humans to be following shortly. And if that's successful, then you'd normally move to a larger trial involving a few thousand healthy people. But in these exceptional circumstances, vaccine researchers will be justified in moving to something much bigger and much faster. If everything goes to plan and the vaccine is shown to be safe and effective, then it's possible that it will be ready to be given to vulnerable people and frontline medical staff this winter, in time for what could be a second outbreak of the virus. That sounds like a long way off to me, doesn't it? So, that's not too positive, but hopefully we'll be over the worst of it by then anyway. Now, the coronavirus itself is a family of viruses named after the halo or corona of protein spikes that stud the outside of each virus particle. Four coronaviruses are behind about 20% of cases of the common cold, while three, SARS, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome, MERS, Middle East respiratory syndrome, and COVID-19 can cause severe illness. R0, this figure represents how many people one sick person will on average infect. The higher the R0 value, the more challenging a disease is to control. Measles is highly infectious and has an R0 value of 12 to 18. The R0 value for COVID-19 is 2.5 to 4. So that's not too bad, is it? But a super spreader is someone who infects far more people than average, and this might be because their job means that they're in contact with more people than usual, or their bodies release unusually high amounts of a virus. And herd immunity. When enough people become immune to an illness, either because they've already had it or they've been vaccinated against it, the disease struggles to spread. In other words, there are enough immune people in the herd of a community to protect the few who aren't. And the phrase asymptomatic means someone who has an infection but doesn't have symptoms. Such people can still spread the virus. And of course, we're now becoming familiar with social distancing, reducing the contact you have with other people by working from home or shopping for food only when essential to slow the spread of an infection. And at the start of the pandemic, close contacts of coronavirus patients were traced and given health advice or put into isolation to stop the virus spreading. Now, a close contact is someone who lives in the same household as the person with the virus, has had physical contact, such as shaking hands with them, or been within 2 meters of them for longer than 15 minutes. And an antigen is a substance that the immune system sees as foreign and produces cells called antibodies to fight it off. Various companies are developing antigen tests for COVID-19, and a positive result means someone has the virus at the time of testing. Current NHS tests don't look for an antigen, but for traces of the virus's genetic material. And an antibody is a protein made by the body's immune system to destroy antigens such as COVID-19, and an antibody test can tell if you've had the virus. And personal protective equipment covers clothing and equipment to keep people safe at work. PPE for coronavirus includes gloves, aprons, visors, goggles, and face masks. FFP3 masks provide the highest protection, filtering out at least 95% of airborne particles. The incubation period is the time between catching an infection and symptoms starting, and for coronavirus, this is usually 5 days, but can be as long as a fortnight or as little as a day. That's very vague, isn't it, really? But it just shows you none of us really know if we've been in contact with it. It could take a couple of weeks to come out fully. And epidemiology is the science of how a disease spreads. It's carried out by epidemiologists who investigate where an outbreak started, who is at risk, how to control it, and how to stop it happening again. So what can we do to keep ourselves fit and healthy? I think that's the main thing that we need to focus on. The scientists, the medics, NHS, everybody out there is doing a fantastic job trying to get us all back, the country, the world back to normal as quickly as possible. But meantime, we shouldn't be letting ourselves go to pieces. So if we are well, we should keep ourselves well. Ensure your body is functioning well when and if the virus should hit you. Take a multivitamin. Can't hurt, can it? I know that vitamin C is really recommended, and zinc as well, to keep the body healthy in general. I'm not saying that that's a cure or anything like that, but it certainly is a boost for the immune system. Run or walk at least 4 miles a day. That will be a good target anyway. And if you can't, just even do 1 mile. That's good. Cut down on crisps, chocolate, biscuits. There's no doubt that obesity has a general effect on health, including susceptibility to illness. And maybe take up a language or something like that, so that when you pick up your phone or turn on your laptop, you're not immediately drawn straight to depressing news sites, but to something more positive. Take up a hobby, play the guitar. Any hobby is good for mental health and helps you relax after a hard day's work. You can wipe touch points with diluted bleach, the surfaces, door handles, the doorbell, anything coming into the house, especially from the supermarket. So, you know, and get the whole family to pull together on that. The important thing is to try to control what you can, because everything else really is out of control. This is really happening, you know. So it's important to organise a schedule as well. Plan your day the night before so that you can get up knowing what you're doing. Otherwise, it can all feel a bit overwhelming. Don't watch the news more than once a day, and try to get outside, even if that's just going into the back garden. So it's also important that we try to find ways of appreciating what we have, you know, taking more time to spend with your family and your children, if you have children, and grandchildren, if you're able to spend time with them, or just talking to friends, talking to people, just appreciate what you have and make plans as well for what you're going to do when all this is over. Try out different recipes as well. You know, look at what's in your cupboard. There may be many things in there that are still in date. There might be a few things that are out of date as well. So it could be a good time to throw some things out as well. You know, try different things. Use up the tins you've got in the cupboard, then go out to the supermarket just for the sake of it. If you've got packets of pulses, you know, they count as part of your five a day and are good sources of fibre. And buy frozen fruit and vegetables such as peas, which is a great source of vitamin C. They're important for the immune system, and they have lots of folate in them as well to reduce fatigue. And they're frozen at source, so they contain lots of vitamins and minerals. And people tend to forget that as well. So they're much more fresh because they have to be frozen immediately. You know, just try and take a little break from your phone as well and your laptop or whatever, just to clear your mind. It's important to focus on getting a decent night's sleep as well, because so many people feel mentally exhausted at the moment because of what's going on, but they can't drop off when they get into bed. So just make sure that your evenings are relaxing. Watch the news, but have a cut-off point, maybe about 8 o'clock, where you don't watch it or read it anymore. And have a warm bath, perhaps, before you go to bed. And when you get out of the bath, you get a drop in body temperature, and that helps you sleep. And keep the bedroom cool, and changing bedding regularly also helps. The feel of clean sheets makes it a much more pleasant experience. And maybe a lavender spray as well, because the herb lavender is thought to have sleep-inducing properties and could help you drop off to sleep. So anyway, those are some hints and tips. And I think that a lot of the hints that I've given you are just good advice for life in general as well. And maybe this will make us think a lot more about, you know, about what we do, the ways we act and react, you know, and how we just generally look after our health. So don't let your health slide. It's very important to look after yourself even more, particularly at times like this. So I hope you found this evening's show useful, and I'll be back with you again next week. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.